talking about emancipation and Palestine, what is that? That's inclusive of everything. Obviously, it's dismantling Zionism, but it's also dismantling the patriarchy and homophobia and other forms of social oppression. And so it felt to me that this was something that I needed to own.
Before we end, toward the end of your book, you talk about your decision to go to Palestine. Mm. Describe that journey.
So I grew up in Jordan, and I was never allowed to go to Palestine because there, for Jordanian men specifically, it's very difficult to get visas to go to Palestine. And so I had worked on Hamas Contained as part of my doctoral thesis for years before I had ever visited Palestine. And then when I naturalized as a UK citizen in 2014, that was my opportunity to go back. You know, as I joke in the book, the colonial masters of my grandparents giving me permission to go into Palestine, which is now under the settler colony of Israel. And so it was that was the first trip that I did that I made with my UK passport, and it was incredibly powerful because it felt like I had grown up there. I had never been, but it felt like I had grown up there. The stories of my grandparents, my parents, and it was really important for me to go to Gaza. I didn't spend enough time in Gaza. I wished I had been given more permission to do that.
Tell us what years.
This was in 2015. Mm-hmm. 2015. So a few years after the Israeli military assault in the 2014 war, the devastation was extreme. I mean, now it seems relatively not as extreme as what we're seeing today. But even then, it was shocking to see how the Israeli military assault sort of devastates neighborhoods in Gaza.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Tarek Bakoni, Palestinian analyst and writer. His memoir is just out. It's called Fire in Every Direction. The president of the board of the president of the board of Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, author also of the book Hamas Contained, The Rise and Pacification of Palestinian Resistance. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Emily Anderson and John Hamilton. I'll be in St. Louis Friday night with Q&As in two movie theaters following Steal This Story. Please check out our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a history-making member of Congress from the West is stepping down. How losing immigrant workers hurts funding for Social Security in the Pacific Northwest. And a big case from Oregon makes it to the U.S. Supreme Court, challenging President Trump's tariffs. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 6th, 2025. I'm Minette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Today, Nancy Pelosi announced she will not seek another term in Congress, releasing this message to her longtime supporters.
It was the faith that you had placed in me and the latitude that you have given me that enabled me to shatter the marble ceiling and be the first woman Speaker of the House, whose voice would certainly be heard. It was an historic moment for our country, and it was momentous for our community. Empowering me to bring home billions of dollars for our city and our state. There has been no greater honor for me than to stand on the House floor and say, I speak for the people of San Francisco. I have truly loved serving as your voice in Congress.
KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the Washington, D.C. powerhouse's announcement that she will not seek re-election.
Former Speaker Nancy Pelosi just told us she will not seek re-election to the U.S. House of Representatives. The announcement from the first woman to hold that position came today. Pelosi has represented San Francisco for almost four decades. She said she would finish out her final year in office. Pelosi said, quote, "My message to the city I love is this. San Francisco, know your power. We have made history. We have made progress. We have always led the way," end quote. She added, quote, "And now we must continue to do so by remaining full participants in our democracy and fighting for the American ideals we hold dear." The decision was not unexpected. Many holding office appear to be stepping aside ahead of next year's midterm elections. There are clearly several newcomers who appear eager to lead the Democratic Party and confront Donald Trump. Pelosi still remains a voice to be reckoned with. She played a recent pivotal role with California's redistricting effort, Proposition 50, and maintains a heavy schedule of public events and party fundraising. She helped build the Affordable Care Act and has been a leader on the international stage. Pelosi, now 85, actually came to politics late in life as a mother of five children. Her first campaign slogan was, quote, "A voice that will be heard." Pelosi's decision also comes after her husband of more than six decades, Paul Pelosi, was badly injured 3 years ago when an intruder broke into the couple's home, called out her name, and attacked him with a hammer. As Speaker, she steered the House in passing landmark legislation, including the Affordable Care Act, the Dodd-Frank financial reforms, and a repeal of the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. After Trump's unexpected 2016 election, she became the first speaker in 50 years to regain the seat. She appeared to be the Democratic Party's antidote to Trump. Trump was impeached twice by the House, though the Senate acquitted him in both cases. After Democrats lost control of the House in the 2022 midterm elections, Pelosi announced she would not seek another term as party leader. She took on the title of Speaker Emerita. Pelosi clearly was an unmatched force for the Democratic Party, having fundraised more than $1 billion over her career. Her next steps are uncertain. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Deportations threaten Social Security funding for the Pacific Northwest and the rest of the U.S. That's according to a new report that spotlights the economic impact of lost immigrant workers under the Trump administration's mass deportation policies. More from KBOO's Lizard.
President Donald Trump is making good on campaign promises to deport immigrants living in Washington and across the U.S. who are without proper documentation. A new report spotlights the economic risk to Social Security and other programs that rely on payroll tax revenues. As America's baby boomers continue to retire, the number of U.S.-born workers is expected to dramatically decrease over the next decade. An estimated 344,000 people are undocumented in Washington, and in 2022, they paid nearly $1 billion in state and local taxes. Report author Josh Bivens says historically normal GDP growth rates will be impossible to maintain without immigrant workers.
It does make things like Social Security and Medicare a little harder to sustain. If we have a steady flow of younger immigrant workers coming in, that just makes it much easier to sustain those really important social insurance programs.
Medicare and Social Security are largely funded by today's workers, regardless of their immigration status, through payroll taxes. According to Social Security trustees, the program will not be able to pay full benefits after 2036. The Trump administration says it hopes to deport 1 million immigrants each year to secure borders and jobs for U.S.-born workers. More than 1.2 million immigrants disappeared from the U.S. labor force in the first half of 2025, according to Pew Research Center analysis. Increases in immigration actually lead to more jobs overall and higher wages for U.S.-born workers, the National Bureau of Economic Research found. Bivens found that the loss of immigrant workers will also hurt U.S.-born workers.
The really immigrant-heavy part of residential construction is maybe the framing and digging out the foundation. Well, if that doesn't get done, the part of construction that is more intensive in the use of U.S.-born workers, like maybe the electrician and the plumber, they can't do their work.
Immigrants make up nearly 20% of the overall U.S. workforce. Nearly half of farming, fishing, and home healthcare work is done by immigrants. 30% of all construction workers and 24% of service industry workers are immigrants. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Lizard.
Oregon is taking a big leadership role in a case before the U.S. Supreme Court, challenging President Trump's assertion that he has the power to set tariffs. Chief Justice John Roberts zeroed in on the question of who actually pays the cost of the tariffs in this exchange with D. John Sauer, the U.S. Solicitor General, representing the Trump administration in this case.
If a tariff is imposed on either automobiles, who pays them?
Regardless of who the importer of record is, there'd be a contract that would go along the sort of line of transfer that would allocate the tariff, and there'd be different, you know, sometimes the foreign producer would pay them, sometimes the importer would bear the cost. The importer could be an American, could be a foreign company. A lot of times it's a wholly owned American subsidiary of a foreign corporation. So it gets allocated. The empirical estimates range from like 30% to 80% of like how much is borne by
Americans. I mean, it's been suggested that the tariffs are responsible for a significant reduction in our deficit. I would say that's raising revenue domestically.
There certainly is an incidental and collateral effect of the tariffs that they do raise revenue, but it's very important that they are regulatory tariffs, not revenue-raising tariffs. And the way you can see this, I think, if you look at this policy is by far the most effective.
Neil Katyal argued for the states, including Oregon, and small business owners challenging the tariffs.
The Constitution, our framers, 238 years of American history, all say only Congress has the power to impose tariffs on the American people. And tariffs are nothing but taxes on the American people, paid by Americans. This case is not about the president. It's about the presidency. It's not about partisanship. It's about principle. And above all, it's about upholding the majestic separation of powers.
Dan Rayfield, Oregon's attorney general, was in the nation's capital, where the case he originally filed to challenge Trump's tariff authority has now reached the U.S. Supreme Court.
We're proud to bring this case. I think there was something that was incredibly important that was said, and it wasn't said by any of our attorneys. It was said by President Donald Trump's Solicitor General when he looked Justice Roberts squarely in the eyes and said the American people, not foreign countries, but the American people are going to pay 30 to 80% of these tariffs. And then had the gall to look all of those justices again in the eye and say that these are not taxes on the American people. And they're doing it by abusing an emergency power. And I think that was the conversation that we heard. Very proud of our attorneys and proud to have these amazing partners in A.G. Mays and A.G. Bonta along in this incredibly important fight when America is facing an affordability crisis.
Thank you, A.G. Rayfield. I'm Chris Mays. I'm the Attorney General of Arizona. We feel really good about the arguments and the questions that were asked by the justices. We brought this case, and this case is so important, maybe the most important case that this court has heard in 100 years, especially to our economy and to consumers and to businesses large and small. And that's why we brought this case, because number one, these tariffs are illegal. They were not predicated in the law or the Constitution. But most importantly, they are impacting the people of our states. We have small businesses that are going out of business every day. I've talked to a furniture manufacturer, a restaurateur, a hotel owner, cattle ranchers, all of whom are struggling because of these tariffs and because they're raising prices on the people of this country. And so we needed to come here and we need to win this case. And that's why we're here. We appreciate the opportunity to make these arguments. And I'll turn it over to my colleague, Rob Bonta.
Rob Bonta, California Attorney General, and grateful to be here with my colleagues on behalf of the states that have brought suit to support the American people who deserve better, who deserve to not have costs raised, who deserve to not be the victims of unlawful tariffs or taxes. Congress has the power to impose taxes. The president does not. He has used tariffs in a sweeping manner to impose 10 to 145% taxes on nearly every one of our trade partners, and workers are suffering, businesses are suffering, families across the country are suffering because of his unlawful conduct. And California is the fourth largest economy in the world, the biggest state in the nation. We are the largest importer of any state, the second largest exporter, the largest exporter of ag. We're the biggest manufacturer. We have an outsized economy, so these tariffs have an outsized impact on the people of our state and on our state. So I thought the argument surfaced all of the key issues, and we are hopeful for a decision. We won't predict or speculate about what might happen, but I thought it was a great argument, and we hope that when the decision is made by the Supreme Court, we will be able to deliver the relief that Americans deserve, to have their costs lowered and not have a president who acts brazenly and blatantly in lawless manners, as he has done with the violation of the law here, when he has no statutory authority to impose these taxes.
I think all three of us feel a very heavy burden because we know that we have to win this case. What is at stake for the state of Arizona, like all the states, frankly, is that prices, if we don't win and these tariffs are allowed to stay in place, prices are going to continue to go up. These are taxes. We are now, Americans are now dealing with an average 17.5% national sales tax because of these tariffs. That's what this is. And so what's going to happen is consumers are going to continue to pay more. It's going to be a really rough Thanksgiving. It's going to be a really rough Christmas and holiday season. And our small businesses are going to continue to go out of business if these tariffs are allowed to stay in place. And so the stakes of this particular argument could not possibly be higher for our country and for our economy. this is a court that has favored the idea that when an agency does something that is extraordinary and major, it cannot do so without going to Congress first. And a couple of the justices compared the tariff scheme that Trump put in place to a major question or the major question doctrine. I thought that was a really good sign. Again, we're not going to predict anything, but I thought it was a good sign for the plaintiffs, for us. Our lawsuits are driven by the law and by the Constitution. Is it on my bucket list to sue Donald Trump? Absolutely not. This is not what I get up every day wanting to do. But if Donald Trump decides to violate the Constitution, violate statute, or harm the people of Arizona, I'm going to file that lawsuit. And the 30 lawsuits that I have entered have saved the state of Arizona $1.5 billion. And it's interesting that the Republican AGs are not filing these lawsuits. And as a result, their people are losing billions of dollars.
And I would also just, when you look at the partisan thing, we're talking about whether any lawsuit is partisan. We have a very sterile analysis. Are Oregonians being harmed? If the answer is yes, is the Constitution or a law being violated? If the answer to those two questions are yes, we're filing a lawsuit. And what everybody should note is in all of these cases where we've sought immediate relief, we've been overwhelmingly successful. Look at this tariff case right now. We have judges who were appointed by Trump, multiple judges, that ruled in our favor because these are foundational principles of how our democracy is put together. And I think you saw that here. A lot of this stuff, it doesn't matter where you come from, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. These are incredibly important issues that are affecting all of us. And right now it's our pocketbooks. If you watch the Netflix, The World of the Upside Down, you have Stranger Things. We're in the world of the upside down. If you go back to Ronald Reagan, and Canada was doing this. They're literally putting ads on TV of Ronald Reagan, and then our president gets incredibly sensitive. He's thin-skinned, and then all of a sudden he increases tariffs again. What a better argument for what's going on right now. But effectively, tariffs can be a very helpful tool in trade when you have someone that's trying to manipulate markets. We want to have fair, balanced competition. But in a case right now where we're being used punitively, where there aren't emergencies and they're taking powers away from Congress, that's what this is really about. So I see consistency in how we're using this case and how we're using this in the impacts of tariffs, very consistent. But it is odd to me to have free trade Republicans fearful to speak out, and you have the Canadian government using the standard bearer for the American Republican Party, Ronald Reagan, against themselves.
I'm a former Republican. It is insane and bizarre that we have a president of the United States right now who is engaged in an almost 18% national sales tax that violates the Constitution and violates federal law. So this is not the Republican Party that I used to belong to at all, ever. It is not something that Republicans used to believe in, but they are now allowing it to happen out of the White House and saying nothing about it in Congress.
When I think about remedies of what this president has done, because I'm absolutely positive that his lawyers looked him in the eyes and said, hey, what you're doing is debatably not constitutional. You don't have the power to do it. He did it anyway. And he did it in a way that our small businesses and consumers and everybody across this country are paying for the bill. I teach my son, when you screw up, you make it right. And I believe that's what the president needs to do. The implementation of how you make it right needs to be done in a conversation with the appropriate government agencies. In a perfect world, if you paid a given tariff out as a small business, especially when you've got small margins to get through each month, that money should be repaid back.
I just want to make a comment about state AGs who have come together. I want to say I'm very proud to be with this incredible coalition of AGs who've together brought over 50 cases. Want to also say that we're winning over 80% of these cases, so we're prevailing. We don't ask ourselves a partisan question. We ask ourselves a legal question. Is the president breaking the law? That's the only question. If the law and the facts indicate that he is and he's hurting our states, then we sue him. If the facts and the law indicate that he's complying with the law, we don't sue him. We don't want to sue him. We hope that the president will follow the law. Not a lot to ask that the president of the United States of America follow the law and comply with the Constitution, but he is repeatedly breaking the law. And so we meet him at the boundaries of his authority. And we say, you shall not cross here. You cannot pass here. You cannot move beyond this authority and do unlawful things. You can only do lawful things. And so that's why we're here. And the unlawful action that he has taken is hurting the American people, hurting the people in our states, hurting businesses, families, and workers. And We're here to make things right, and hopefully we'll get a remedy from this court.
I think we all feel like we're going to wait for this court to rule. We feel good about the arguments that were made, and we feel good about the questions that came back from this bench. We are hoping that this court will decide that the administration violated the Constitution. These tariffs need to go away. We needed to slay this dragon called tariffs or taxes because the people of this country are hurting. They are now laboring under the triple whammy of ACA price increases, SNAP benefits not coming through in Thanksgiving, and tariffs that are driving up inflation. We need to win this case. It's been a long time since we've had a president who was willing to violate the Constitution on a near weekly basis. And so we are seeing concepts come up like the non-delegation doctrine, like separation of powers that haven't been a problem for hundreds of years or certainly decades.
People have been on both sides of this fence throughout the week. But what we talk about is what is the current structure of our case law here in America today. That is what needs to be applied to the rules that are going on right now. And the truth of the matter is, you heard them talk about that $4 trillion of tariff revenue. If you use even 25%, that's lower than the math that they told the justice. That's a $1 trillion hidden tax on the American people. $1 trillion. And there wasn't a single vote taken in that building over there. And that's what the Constitution requires when you're raising revenue in this country. And right now, if you allow the president to continue to do this, you can raise taxes on anything, hidden taxes, left and right, on any good, any amount, for any duration, and all of us are going to pay the cost. That's why this is so important. If we were to lose this case, it's an important conversation for the American people to say, is this what we really want in our country? And it allows Congress to have information to cabin the authority of the president if we are, because this is an American conversation because we're all paying for it as Americans.
And Oregon's First District Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici had this reaction.
I just left the United States Supreme Court while I was into the argument challenging the president's authority to unilaterally impose tariffs. But Trump's chaotic tariff policy has caused harm and rising costs in Oregon and across the country. And a good case was made why that power does not belong to the president. It belongs to Congress. So we'll wait for the decision, but it was an honor to be in the Supreme Court to listen to the case. And we're hoping for the best. It's going to really matter to the economy in the United States and to the rising costs that, you know, we are seeing right now with this chaotic tariff policy.
Another Democratic congresswoman from Oregon, Maxine Dexter, also weighed in.
I just spent the morning in the Supreme Court listening to Oregon's team, our attorney general, fighting for the American people, protecting working families from being taxed with tariffs. Here are my takeaways. Number one, we absolutely have to understand that tariffs are taxes. They generate revenue, and the power of the purse belongs with Congress, not with the president. Number two, this case has enormous implications. This is precedent that will not be able to be revoked because the president has no self-interest in giving away this power once it's given to him. So the Supreme Court is weighing whether or not they care about the people of America and the Constitution or Donald Trump. And lastly, Oregon showed up. It was extraordinary to know that we are leading and you have one of the most effective attorneys general in the country. So I am honored to be here serving you. Dan Rayfield is serving you. I hope that the Supreme Court will also serve you.
Economists say farmers will lose hundreds of dollars per acre this year for their corn, cotton, long grain rice, and soybean crops. As Frieda Ross reports, the farmers say they're feeling increased financial pressure as the longest government shutdown in history continues.
Tim Wells is the owner of Sugar Creek Ranch in Paragould and the vice president for agriculture loans at First National Bank. He says growers were already suffering financially because of the price of supplies and the trade wars.
It's been pretty stressful the last couple of years, trying to just follow everything with the prices in the markets like they've been. So we need to throw something else on that less stress and just fall through the harvest. Mr. Fulmer Mill on the thousand.
Arkansas soybean farmers have been especially hurt since China purchased its soybeans from Argentina. The Trump administration has said it would release emergency farm assistance, but no firmer details have been released. Farmers say the continued shutdown leads to distrust in the federal government. Many farmers depend on federal loans and grants to buy equipment and for daily operations. Says even if funds become available, it would take longer to process the paperwork because many government workers have been fired.
It's federal to inform Children's Agency. So if there's no employees there to say, this is what we're doing, put I in a budget amounts and look at when I went to, if I don't get the money, that's not less difference.
This is the harvest season for many commodity farmers. They typically apply for Commodity Credit Corporation loans during this time to cover operating cost. This story was produced with original reporting from Rebecca Alvey for Civil Eats. I'm Freda Ross.
President Trump blames GOP losses in key governor's races on the government shutdown. And Republicans sue to block California's new redistricting efforts. For the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
The shutdown was a big factor, negative for the Republicans, and they say that I wasn't on the ballot was the biggest factor.
President Donald Trump says the ongoing government shutdown was a deciding factor in Democrats sweeping all competitive governor's races on Election Day. Trump's approval is at a new low, and although both parties are unpopular, Democrats have a slim lead in generic polling. Surveys suggest voters blame Trump and congressional Republicans slightly more for the shutdown, but would hold them especially responsible for more than doubling of ACA health insurance premiums if pandemic-era tax credits expire. The Democrats are also pointing to New York City, which elected its first Muslim mayor running as an economic populist. Democratic Socialist Assemblyman Zohar Mamdani beat former Governor Andrew Cuomo and Republican nominee Curtis Sliwa and will be the youngest mayor in decades. Mamdani says he'll move to freeze rent as the city faces record high housing costs. After his victory, he said the election ends a political dynasty and restores power to working class New Yorkers.
Palms calloused from delivery bike handlebars, knuckles scarred with kitchen burns. These are not hands that have been allowed to hold power. And yet over the last 12 months, you have dared to reach for something greater.
Trump initially threatened to cut funds for essential programs in the city if Mamdani won and said he might deploy the National Guard to the city. Republicans are suing to block California's voter-approved congressional maps from going into effect. Proposition 50 passed by a huge majority and will let state lawmakers redistrict early one time without going through the normal nonpartisan system. The GOP suit argues that violates the 14th and 15th Amendments by favoring Hispanic voters. Governor Gavin Newsom says Trump and Republicans have forced the issue because they know they're unpopular going into next year's midterms.
Why else would he call Greg Abbott saying he's entitled to five seats? Why else is he trying to rig the midterm elections before one single vote is even cast? He understands his position at this moment.
Speaker of the House Mike Johnson feels people shouldn't see the election results as a rebuke of Republicans. He says his caucus will have a proven track record to run on next year.
We cut taxes, cut regulations, cut waste, fraud, and abuse in government. We solved the border crisis, which was the number one issue on the ballot last fall. We're solving the crime crisis around the country. We've got American energy dominance revved and going again.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Wisconsin tribal leaders are split on a sports gambling expansion bill. Gila River gives a $1,000 relief payment to every 18-year-old tribal member. And a Lumbee chairman tells senators he's confident on a federal recognition bill. Here's National Native News with Antonia Gonzalez.
Some tribal leaders are supporting a proposed bill that could expand sports betting in Wisconsin. Chuck Kornbach has more.
About three dozen states allow some form of sports betting, but in Wisconsin, the only legal way to place a wager on a sporting event is at some tribal casinos. Proposed legislation would allow Wisconsin tribes to operate computer servers and other technology so that sports gamblers could be anywhere in the state and place a bet online. Jeff Crawford is Attorney General of the Forest County Potawatomi. He told a legislative hearing that allowing tribes to offer more sports betting would encourage gamblers to turn away from using illegal and unreliable offshore betting firms.
While online gaming is currently at the Wild West in Wisconsin with no regulations or protections for consumers, it does not have to be.
Kyle White Eagle is a tribal legislator for the Ho-Chunk Nation. He says his tribe provides a lot of services across a wide geographic area and needs additional gaming revenue to better tackle problems like poverty and opioid addiction.
Giving tribes in Wisconsin the right to conduct mobile sports betting isn't going to solve these problems completely, but it will help significantly and it will be funding well spent.
But a coalition of national commercial sports gambling firms, including DraftKings and FanDuel, opposes the Wisconsin bill. Attorney Damon Stewart of the Sports Betting Alliance says gamblers would lose out if legally they could only go through the tribes.
Unfortunately, this bill will not result in a competitive market for online sports betting that provides consumers with choice.
If the mobile sports betting bill passes in Wisconsin, it would still take time for the state to renegotiate gaming compacts with the tribes and for the U.S. Interior Department to approve the gaming expansion. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Quirnbach.
An Arizona tribe is giving its members some financial relief as the federal government shutdown continues, impacting programs like food assistance. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
The Gila River Indian community is calling them general welfare payments, one-time $1,000 disbursements for each 18-year-old tribal member, regardless of whether they're a SNAP recipient. That decision came on Saturday during a special counsel session called by Governor Stephen Roe Lewis.
I hope that this payment brings some peace of mind during this time of uncertainty at the federal level.
Lewis urges his tribe south of Phoenix to plan for the long haul.
So please, use or set aside for your food needs to pay bills and to add some measure of economic security.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The chairman of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina says he's confident that this year full services and benefits will be extended to his tribe. Chairman John Lowry made the remarks Wednesday during a legislative hearing on the Lumbee Fairness Act, which would grant the tribe federal recognition. Lowry says his tribe has long sought federal status.
I'm a descendant of Solomon Locklear Sr., one of the 44 tribal leaders who in 1888, petitioned Congress to recognize the Lumbee tribe. Today, 137 years later, I stand before you once again advocating for justice and equal treatment through full federal recognition.
Wednesday's hearing in the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs included opposition. Leaders from the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians of North Carolina and the Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma testified against the bill, while Lowry submitted a list of tribal support and testified that nearly all of North Carolina's congressional delegation backs the bill. President Trump, in a statement this week, issued his support for the Lumbee tribe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 6, 2025.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation.